Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration
and
energy.
I just want to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC Radio.
This is such an important role as it focuses around defending human rights and anti-discrimination as it's experienced by Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people, but as the Australian Human Rights Commission being Australia's leading human rights institution.
In conversation with June Oscar, this is Speaking Out, I'm Larissa Berendt. When June Oscar was the first woman to be appointed as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner in 2017, she had already dedicated her life to improving the lives of Aboriginal people in remote communities. She brought her experience working at the coalface in the Kimberley to a leading national human rights advocacy position. She'd been Deputy Director of the Kimberley Land Council, Chair of the Kimberley Language Resource Centre and the Kimberley Interpreting Service, to name just a few of the community roles she'd undertaken. But I first came to know of Aunty June Oscar through her work at Fitzroy Crossing, where her Bunuba people come from. June managed to get enough of the community on board to push for alcohol restrictions. She then worked very hard to prevent and manage fetal alcohol syndrome disorder in her town and beyond. Aunty June received the Menzies School of Health Research Medallion for this really important work. She's now about to finish her term as Social Justice Commissioner, so we're so privileged to get the chance to look back on her achievements in the role, the life that shaped her, and to ponder what might happen next. Aunty June Oscar, welcome back to Speaking Out.
Thank you, Larissa.
So we might start just by getting a sense. I've always known you from when I first became aware of your really important work, that you have a really strong sense of social justice. And I wonder if you could share with us where that came from and what shaped your values.
Yeah, sure. Look, I think that really came through from the way I was raised and where I was raised. And what I witnessed as a child, as a young person, as a young adult, and as an adult, in how the whole system and society and external processes impacted on the lives of Aboriginal people in the Kimberley. And if you were a white person, you had more authority over what and how things happen to Aboriginal people. And I saw all that, you know, being a child born before the 1967 referendum, when our people had no rights whatsoever, no recognition, were the domestic labour force, you know, the women were, to cattle station managers, owners, and the men worked with stock handling and building the infrastructure on cattle properties. And where I grew up, I was raised on Bunuba country, which had been turned into two massive million-acre properties owned by non-Indigenous people. And so the treatment of my people was something I became to understand as not being right, that we are people, we have feelings, we have ideas, and we can live a different life where we're more respected and treated as human beings. That in itself, in how I was raised by two amazing, strong, Bunuba women, my mother and my grandmother, and being taught about the world of the Bunuba through the Bunuba language. So English is not my first language. And becoming who I am started from the way that I was parented, the way that I was allowed to, as a child, to explore the world around me, as did many other Bunuba kids who grew up on the same properties that I did on Bonobo Country and learning about the world of the Bonobo, but bearing witness to this treatment by other people of our families, people we loved, people who nurtured and protected us. And so that stayed with me as a kid, being then sent to Fitzroy Crossing to attend the government school, which was a very traumatizing experience for me. I cannot remember being taken to Fitzroy, but I remember the first night in a strange bed in a dark place at the dormitory and crying through the night. And it was the first time I had been removed from my mother and from the safety and protection of my family. And so, you know, we adjust over time. And I loved going to school and learning. And I loved to, you know, read and be informed. And so I took a real liking to reading, writing. I didn't like numbers that much, but I did get through that. And returning to family, to all things familiar, to this other world was so important. And, you know, I feel so blessed to have been able to do that. So returning at each holiday period to family was important. And as I grew into, you know, the young adult, I went away to Perth to attend high school there and then experience racism from white kids at my school in Perth. And then cutting that off at year 11, returning to Fitzroy Crossing and enrolling at a vocational training centre in Port Hedland with many other young Aboriginal kids from the Pilbara, from the Gascoyne and from the Kimberley. We were supported there. There were staff there that were familiar to me who had taught me at the Fitzroy School, and I saw that as a real support and benefit for me to feel comfortable, confident, yet in another space, but having people there that knew my family, knew me, and invested into my learning. And so it went from there. You know, I was 18 years of age. I returned to the Kimberley, or returned to Derby, actually. Took up an opportunity to be a relief, you know, typist receptionist at the West Australian Aboriginal Legal Service. It was there, you know, typing affidavits and court documents for the lawyers, that I was able to have my eyes open and have this real political awareness around the fact that as black people, as Aboriginal people, we have rights and we can seek out justice. And so that really struck a chord in terms of what my interest area would be. And so that also gave me confidence in speaking up and assisting our senior people who spoke many other languages before English, and then to be able to communicate the contents of important documents to them so that they were making informed decisions. And whilst people were, the elders were very, very strong and confident in their knowledge of their customary decision-making and different concepts, when presented with information that was coming from the outside world, so from governments and corporates and others, having that presented to them in the way that they could grasp it and then make the decision, was just so important. And that was the way I thought, no, you know, we're going to have our say. We're going to have our voices heard. We have ideas around what we think is important in our lives. So that was my entree into this world of community advocacy, of social justice, of holding to our truths and speaking with the confidence of who we are as human beings and as Australia's First Peoples.
It's always struck me, I think it's been so strong in how you've shaped your values publicly, that it's really clear that you have a strong connection to your country and who you are, but you have ensured that you've been educated to understand how the systems work so you can be a powerful advocate within. Like you, I loved reading and I liked school as well. And also like you, I wasn't very good with the numbers, but I loved the rest of it. And I guess in you, I always saw somebody who was able to get that education, but to be so grounded in where you were from and who you were and who your people were, that actually that was the great driver for you.
Yeah, and in that process of shaping the adult that we become, and my mother shared with me that children are born to be wise and responsible elders, but we must ensure that we apply this process of ensuring that these young people become the responsible people that we need them to be. So, you know, the ceremonies around what is, you know, sometimes referred to as smoking ceremony, but it was a ceremony of, you know, blessing and speaking to the child at different stages of development throughout our, you know, childhood development into adults. Where now I practice that with, you know, my mob in ensuring that young children are smoked and are taught and are told the rules around being respectful, being helpful, being strong and confident. So there are many other things in how we lived our lives that fed into shaping our knowledge and giving us confidence. And that's certainly where I receive my groundedness and confidence. And my grandmother, she didn't trust white fellas, but she just tolerated them. But she was, you know, she was strong. She just knew every plant, animal, water place, rock formation, hills, rivers, creeks and springs on Boonooba country. And, you know, I just had a wonderful opportunity of being raised by her.
She sounds like she was an encyclopedia.
Well, they all are. Yeah. They all are. No matter where we come from, our old people have inherited, you know, 65,000 years of knowledge, intergenerational knowledge transmission. This is all so important that we hold that in our memory, but we keep it alive by still practicing and speaking and sharing these knowledges.
That culture, that wisdom, that strength is so evident in who you are as one of our, you know, really admired leaders, one of our really strong female leaders. But you've also shared a more recent experience about connecting with your father's family for the first time and how that bridged a common divide in Australia. Can you share with us a little bit about what that element has been like for you?
Yeah, that was pretty kind of nervous thought to have, and whether I should do it or I shouldn't. But I tell you, once I reached 50 and beyond, I'm 62 now, and this was a few years ago, I thought, you know, I'm of this age. I think it's important that my father's family. So he's a white pastoralist of the Kimberley. And I thought it was important for them to know that we existed. I didn't want anything from my siblings or my father's family. I just thought it was their right to know, and whatever happens from there, you know, will remain until we make contact. So, mind you, this is, you know, this was something that a lot of the white pastoralists knew about, that he had fathered us kids, but no one says anything. They just keep it quiet. And this is the story of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of Aboriginal people of mixed descent across this country. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to reach out, make contact. After my brother had given me a number that he received from a person that was known to my brother, but also known to my biological father. So that, yeah, that triggered that. And you know what? The rest is history. I've had the privilege and opportunity to connect with some really beautiful people that I'm related to. And we keep in contact quite regularly. And, you know, they are some of our strongest supporters for Indigenous rights. And, you know, they're strong allies. They were before us, but they're even more strong allies now because they have Indigenous relatives. But this is a story they also wanted to share with the Australian public. This is about the truth-telling that needs to happen in this country. Some pretty famous people, white people in this country, have fathered children with Aboriginal mothers, with Aboriginal women. You know, we've got to be able to respect that, but expose that in the right way, that we can't live in denial as if, you know, we just landed here and this is the colour of our skin and this is how we are. For me, you know, I have the good fortune of having my siblings being born and raised on Boonooba country, so they have memories of their own lives there with our father and their mother. And so do I. I have memories, and my siblings have memories of being, you know, growing up on the same country. And so we've got a lot to talk about, a lot in common. You know, they keep saying, wish we'd known earlier, wish we'd known sooner. But we know now. We can't undo whatever were the reasons in our father's lives. That belongs to that time. But we're empowered and have the good, you know, opportunity through having a wonderful relationship and having this blood connection to creating the next chapter of our family's history.
That's June Oscar. She's spent her life working hard to improve the lives of First Nations people, particularly in remote communities like Fitzroy Crossing, where she's from. June managed to get alcohol restrictions in her hometown as part of her work to deal with fetal alcohol syndrome. She says the restrictions had widespread benefits for everyone, not just Aboriginal people. And she says the success was an example of First Nations communities leading policy change that works for them.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, ABCRN, Radio Australia on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app? And that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. Coming up, we've got more from my chat with June Oscar, but right now, some music from Electric Fields. They've just been announced as Australia's representatives in this year's Eurovision contest. Here they are with One Milkily, or One Blood.
I stand in the eye of the spiral, one of the billion, billions, billion, billions. My soul slips away from its title, one of the billion, billions. And I descend to the center of the earth,
618. What you gonna do in the real world, Mickey? What you gonna do when you see Mel Alley? Mel Alley, go to Mel Alley. This cake we us to the planets, to the Fleetwood Max and the Janets. Mel Alley live while into.
That's Electric Feels with One Milkily or One Blood, and we are sure they're going to wow everybody at Eurovision.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
June Oscar's about to wrap up her role as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. She was appointed to this role with the Human Rights Commission in 2017. I mentioned earlier that I first came to know of you. I think many people working in the rights area nationally came to know of you through your work in Fitzroy Crossing in getting the community support for an alcohol ban, which wasn't easy. What made you so driven to make that change, and how did you eventually get enough community support for it?
Well, it was, again, a community priority and a really important discussion that women were having around the deaths that we had experienced in 12 months in my hometown. We had 50 deaths in 1 year, and they were preventable deaths and alcohol-related deaths. We couldn't be living in this country and being stuck in a rut of grief and sadness and loss. And darkness, and not really get to the root causes of why this was happening to us. These were young people who were at the peak of their lives and full of potential, as well as senior people, men, women. But it just went, oh yeah, another person died. We as a community were attending funerals every week in that year, you know, 52 weeks in a year. We had 50 deaths. We only had 2 weeks off from attending funerals. At our annual Women's Bush meeting, we talked about that, and it was at the time that Mal Brough and his government, his party, were introducing the measures into the Northern Territory, and they had their sights on the Kimberley as well. The fear that was amongst our community, especially from young kids, around how the army had come into communities in the Northern Territory and were screening people. I remember young kids asking their parents, is the army coming here? What are they going to do to us? So this is all the goings on in the community in terms of what people were seeing, feeling, experiencing right in our community, in our families' lives, and the no response from outside in terms of the support, but yet the response from outside was punitive. It was being so judgmentally, you know, driven, and it was white fellas again thinking they knew the answer and what needed to happen to Aboriginal people. So we got in first, if I can say that, at our bush meeting at Mingalgala on Gunyandi country. We, in 2007, we decided to write to the Director General of Liquor Licensing in Western Australia and ask him to impose alcohol restrictions to the drive-through in Fitzroy Crossing. And then that triggered a process where he arrived in Fitzroy Crossing and so did the police hierarchy, as well as local government and the licensees. And we were part of a process of trying to reach agreement around how we deal with this. Now, this, you know, the statistics were that there was 250,000 litres of pure ethanol sold in a community of 3,500 people.
That's shocking.
You know, to non-Indigenous outside of our community and within the community, people are saying, oh, yeah, blackfellas can drink themselves to death. We don't care. They don't care. We had jobs, identified positions, funding programs to support these positions. We were battling as a community to employ people into those roles because, you know, those who weren't drinking were unable to go and do a full day's work because of the levels of drinking next door or across the road. You know, this was impacting everyone, whether you drank or not. So we were a community in absolute crisis, but there was no response. You know, the police were running around putting out spot fires of family and domestic violence, being at these incidences with families and picking up the pieces. And police were suffering the burnout in our community. We couldn't hold a non-Indigenous workforce into some of the critical service delivery roles funded by government. So the agencies, nurses, doctors, teachers, people were impacted upon so much so that their tenure in our community was very short. So, you know, this is a huge public health crisis we were confronted with, and it was impacting generations. And so when we called for the alcohol restrictions, and my good friend, colleague and chair at the time, Ms. Emily Carter, her and I, with our board of directors, led this. And, you know, I could not have done it without Emily, and I know she'd say the same, but we could not have done it without the support that we received from our community. And, you know, we had people say to us, oh, how many women supported this? And I said, well, what does it matter? If one woman is in pain in this community, we have to respond. If it's 100 women, it doesn't matter.
I thought one of the really important lessons that you showed by this really important work that you were doing was how significant women's leadership can be, and also the importance of having communities come up with the solutions to what seem to be intractable problems that outsiders can't fix. At least to people watching the work and the transformation from outside, they seem to be the lessons. From where you were sitting and when you look back on it, what did you learn through going through the process of making these significant changes around what was a really intractable issue in the community?
That our voices in raising these issues that impact our lives on a daily basis must be listened to, because there's no one else that lives in our reality than us that knows what the solutions are. And so, you know, that's an ongoing matter, not just in community, but nationally. Listen to us. We do have the solutions. We know how to best respond and approach these issues, but there's never been a real open system and mechanism for us to help inform those who have the power and authority and influence over resources and abilities that can help bring about the change in the way that we can design the responses. And, you know, there is no handbook about how to be a leader in this type of complex environment. So there has to be value placed and recognition placed on the vital role of people's lived experiences and the evidence that is presented from that. And that is communicated through their voice. So we need to be able to create the spaces that engages fully the people that need to be in that space to help, you know, inform and create effective policy, legislation, and better structures to deliver better outcomes for our communities.
It's, I think, really important to remember how much of that work you did and how visible it was to the rest of us around the country watching what you were doing there, because when you came to be Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, it was heralded, of course, and embraced because you were the first woman appointed to the role. But actually, I think from a community perspective, it was much more than that. It was because you had done this kind of real hard yards back in the community. What made you want to come and do that role, to move from your country and take on a national role? Was it an easy decision or a hard one?
Oh, look, it was the right time, I thought, right time in my life to throw my hat in the ring, as they say. I thought, as a Aboriginal woman, I've seen some great men in this role and I absolutely respect them, but I think it's time for Aboriginal women to occupy this role at a national level. And this is such an important role, as it focuses around defending human rights and anti-discrimination as it's experienced by Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people, but as the Australian Human Rights Commission being Australia's leading human rights institution. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be fantastic, having spent 12 years at Maninwandigura, the Women's Resource Centre in Fitzroy Crossing, working with incredible Aboriginal women, local, those who came from outside, and the non-Indigenous women who came with their skills, their gifts, their talents to work in that community. I thought, wouldn't it be good to try and bring a focus to women's issues at this national level within human rights and self-determination and the right to agency, and to elevate voices of women who often don't get heard.
I think if one looks back at your time as Social Justice Commissioner, you've stayed very true to that. You've had some major projects that have focused, amongst the many other work pieces of work that you've done more holistically, but there's certainly been a strong strand of listening to women's voices and finding a space for them. And of course, one of the key pieces of work was the report that came out in 2020, Wihi Yani Uthangani Women's Voices. Can you tell us a little bit about the process you went through with that and what it's achieved to date?
I was very clear that my national project would be around engagement with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and girls across the country, across all of our diversity in, you know, urban settings, in regional towns, in remote communities and very remote communities, as well as women and young women who were in women's prisons and young women's detention centres. So we focused on what it was that were the priorities of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, but starting from a very empowering and strength-focused way, in asking women, what is it that can, enables you to achieve all that you achieve in terms of your roles, your interests, and, you know, what and who are the critical factors that are your enablers? And then we ask them, what was it that, you know, causes fear, frustration, anxiety, and your drive to want to change something came thirdly. If you could change something, what could it be? And what should that look like? Who should be involved? What's your role in it? They were the questions that we put to the women and girls right across the country. It didn't change. It was the same questions. But I made sure that women and girls, for wherever we went, weren't being asked to be included in a national engagement process or consultation where I set the agenda for what I wanted to hear. I flipped that around to be clear to women and girls is that you talk to me about what you want me to know about you. If you're happy to share that, we'll put that in a report because I'm required to table a report in federal parliament. Women and girls felt, and many commented to me, that they had never been asked to just come to a gathering, to a session, as who they are, as black women. And I said to them, this is what I want you to feel and see in terms of what it looks like to take a human rights-based approach. And women have said, and girls, we've never had this experience before. It's always somebody wanting something from us and saying, we can only talk about this. No one's ever asked me what makes me deadly, what makes me want to strive to make things better, and who are the people that are important to me in my life. And so these gatherings, as you can imagine, Larissa, were quite emotional. So women really opened up and talked from their heart, from right in the pit of their stomachs. And then we met with over 2,000 women and girls, First Nations women and girls. We were able to present the report to federal parliament on the 9th of December 2020, written and spoken in the voices of every single one of those women and girls. It is the first time in Australia that this has happened. I just thought we have to honour our first matriarchs of this country. We have to deliver justice for them. But we have to do it on their terms, on their issues, informed by them through their voices. And so we yani yudangani, which is in my language Bunuba, we meaning women, we yani meaning big mobs of women, u meaning four big mobs of women, and tangani meaning voice or word or language. So that's the name of the report, we yani yudangani, and the project, securing our rights, securing our futures. So, you know, I was proud to present the nation with, you know, a report that's elevated all of those voices on the issues that matter for them, and to assist those in spaces of influence to use that report when they're considering programs and decisions, policies, legislation that impact the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and girls in our country. You know, there is no excuse. That's a landmark report, and it belongs to our First Nations women and girls. And now, as I'm nearing the end of my term, I'm finalising the priorities of Stage 3 in the development of a change agenda that will provide a blueprint for delivering lasting change across relevant policies and programs of government, industry and service providers. So that will drive the work of the We Yani Yudangani Gender Justice Institute that we're establishing at the ANU and will be launching in March this year.
I just think it's so important to note, as you say, in and of itself, that report in 2020 that captured all of those voices, and particularly in the places where women aren't asked, in correctional centres, on the margins, that actually there is through, what I love how you call it a black print, but through the black print and also through the Institute, there's going to be an ongoing legacy of this really important work. For you, Aunty June, when you look back on your time as Social Justice Commissioner, and in fact actually look back on all the things you've achieved, what is the thing that stands out that makes you most proud?
Oh, there's many things. But
I would have imagined there were. You've got a lot to pick from.
When I see young women, all women of all ages, stand up and be so articulate in their right to their voice on the issues that are important for them, and they want to drive the change. They want to be respected and supported in their right to self-determination and agency. And they put forward the ideas around what the priorities are, as the young women leaders did at the May summit in Canberra last year. I just felt, look, you know what? We're in safe hands. They've got this, and we just need to back them. We need to create the space for our young people and nurture them and grow and create the spaces that they can move freely in and out of and own it in a boss way to bring about the change and affect the change that we so desperately need to see, especially around, you know, the gender justice vision that we have. And, you know, we envision an intersectional movement for gender equality that leaves no women behind. And we know, as First Nations women, what it feels like to be tagged on at the end of other mainstream processes, and what it feels like to be add-ons or afterthoughts. No, it is time for change, and we want to drive that in terms of gender justice and equality for First Nations women in this country.
I guess the other question I was going to ask you, just in terms of looking towards the future, many of us feel like we had quite a grueling year last year with the referendum, the energy that went into it, the sorts of difficult conversations that were had, and the emotion of the failure of the referendum, and the fact that 60% of Australians voted against the proposition for giving us a voice. As somebody who's advocated so strongly for the importance of voice going forward, what do you think the pathway is? And do you see that the referendum has impacted on that, or is it just a blip and we're going to move on?
Oh, look, I think with the referendum outcome, we need to be honest and acknowledge that this was a significant event for the nation. The decline in the support for the voice over the course of the campaign period and the ultimate outcome gives cause for reflection. And I hope that many people who voted no, and that was the overwhelming, majority, that they too have time to reflect on what they've just done. We must, I believe, find the strength in the groundswell of that support that you reference. You know, the millions of Australians mobilised around First Nations justice throughout this referendum year, and they are still there with us. They have developed a deepened understanding of our shared histories, the difficulty of making substantive change, and the barriers that need to be overcome. And I've listened and shared in conversation with so many of my non-Indigenous friends and colleagues, and they're as gutted as we are, or even more, because feel like it's their responsibility, but it's all of our responsibility. The ability of our democracy to uphold the rights of all Australians relies on informed citizenship. The referendum and the merciless politics around it have really underscored a harsh reality. It is increasingly challenging, if not impossible, to engage in reasonable and safe public discussions in today's political and media climate. You could see from what was happening during the campaigning how this was going to impact in our ability to have good, robust engagement and debate on critical issues. That put all of that at risk, I believe. The impact of civic dysfunction cannot be overstated. It threatens the very core of our democracy, and this is a significant challenge we must now confront and endeavour to overcome. Your earlier points around the messaging, there is no denying that the wildfire of myths and disinformation that permeated physical and online spaces played a significant role in sowing fear, uncertainty among Australians. And in turn, this fueled, as I said earlier, the unprecedented levels of racism and intolerance against First Nations peoples and communities. And the impact of this is being felt far beyond the vote. As we find steps, or we take steps to find a way forward following the referendum, we all have a role to play in ensuring that the information that's put forward is accurate and that our discussions are well-informed and in good faith. And then whilst the referendum failed to deliver change in the form of a constitutionally enshrined voice, it is clear the status quo will continue to undermine outcomes and further disadvantage First Nations people. And the Uluru statement is no less relevant. The need for genuine representation, truth-telling, and agreement-making still stands. What we have experienced makes it abundantly clear that we need a Makarrata process, a period of truth-telling, healing, and dialogue as a nation, as fellow Australians, so we can reset and move forward together. And, you know, the mechanisms to elevate First Nations voices are critical if we are to reverse decades of policy failure. The establishment of local and regional voices structures, as was discussed in the Indigenous Voice Co-Design Process Report, led by Professors Kalmer and Langton under the former coalition government, it should be supported as a way to ensure our communities are heard and can inform policy making. You know, what we also must remember is that a momentum for change has been created with millions of Australians, and there are numerous paths ahead. And, you know, I just say with open hearts and open minds, we can unite as a nation and navigate our way towards truth and justice and a better future for all who now call these lands home.
We could end on that, Aunty June, but I just wondered just before, what's next for you? You'll finish Social Justice Commissioner with a wonderful legacy that will be ongoing, of course. What's your next adventure?
Well, I will be moving across to help set up the strong foundations for the work that the WIANIU Gender Justice and Equality Institute will be focused on. You know, this is not just a national first, this is a world first for First Nations women and girls.
Aunty June, thank you so much for all the work you've done, both in your community, leading the way for the rest of us to follow, and as an absolutely inspirational social justice commissioner. I've no doubt you're going to just continue to do things that are incredibly important. And I do hope as you move into this next important phase that you continue to connect with us at Speaking Out and continue to help us tell the stories of the work that you're doing.
You know, first woman in the social justice commissioner's role is to be the conduit for the voices on the ground into the places of decision-making and power who need to be informed by those voices on the ground.
Well, it's our privilege to have you as one of our most beloved elders and as a guest on Speaking Out, Aunty June.
Thank you, Larissa.
That's June Oscar, outgoing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner at the Human Rights Commission. Katie Kiss will begin her term in the role at the beginning of next month. Big shoes to fill, but Katie, we think, will be amazing. That's the show for now. Join us again next time when we bring you more inspirational stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Jay McAllister and Sarah Allerley. You can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au and find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Larissa Berendt.